The haircut, Larry I. Palmer. It was a Wednesday, around 8:30 p.m., a week before Thanksgiving, 1958, when I strolled down the third floor corridor of Bancroft Hall towards Ted Bedford's faculty apartment. He was on duty that night, thus the open door. Jeff, one of my fellow preps, what ninth graders were called at Phillips Exeter Academy, had invited me and his roommate Brink to spend the holiday break with his family in Salem, Massachusetts. It was the first time I had visited Bedford's faculty office, a space sealed off in the back foyer of his family living quarters by a mahogany door, exactly like the one I lingered just outside of now, in the dorm hallway, an unsigned permission slip from the dean of students in hand. Bedford sat at his desk, facing away from the wall and poring over some papers as I waited for him to notice me. He turned his head towards me with a glance that asked, "What's up?" His eyebrows becoming question marks as he peered over his glasses. I handed him the slip and asked him to sign it because my advisor was out of town. Bedford pushed his chair away from the desk and spun to face me, his smile so wide it seemed to touch his sideburns. "Well, I got a deal for you. Before I'll sign, you must get a haircut." Get a haircut? There was nothing in the Exeter rule book about the length of students' hair, only that coats and ties were required at all classes, chapel, church, and meals. I figured I had left behind this kind of concern about what Mom referred to as my nappy hair when I left St. Lou 3 months before. Was Ted Bedford, a young history teacher and the junior faculty member in the dorm, making up his own rules? I looked around distractedly for a moment and considered whether I should bring up the rule book. I noticed that on the right edge of Bedford's desk, the only space uncluttered by stacks of paper and books, sat a framed picture of his preschool boys, hair neatly trimmed, parted on the side. I decided it wasn't smart to challenge him on his rules. He had my permission slip in his hand and gave no indication he was going to give it back to me. I knew from previous conversations with Bedford that he was at once the most intimidating, gregarious, and argumentative adult among three faculty members living in Bancroft. I mean, without much effort, he could have played the role of a lawyer in a movie. I regretted that I hadn't been able to get the signature I needed from my advisor, a bachelor who taught French and barely spoke to me, or anyone else other than to say good morning, and who would have signed the slip without question. Instead, I was caught wondering, how could I explain regulations to Bedford why my hair was so long? How could I tell him that I was acutely aware of the fact that all the adults at Exeter, from the janitors, to the principal, to the academy barber, to this grinning 28-year-old, prematurely balding guy sitting in front of me, were what? How seriously I doubted any of them could possibly understand the complexities of my Negro hair. "You must be Palmer," a smiling, sparkling-eyed man said in a familiar Midwestern accent as I entered the dormitory. "I'm Ted Seabrook," he continued as he extended his hand. "I saw you get out of your taxi from my office window. Welcome to Bancroft Hall." I shook his hand, hoping my own face reflected his infectious smile. He told me that he knew St. Lou well. Before coming to Exeter, he'd coached wrestling at a high school in Granite City, Illinois, just across the Mississippi River. The ever-present voices of my parents or older siblings that usually whispered to me what I should do or say when I encountered a stranger disappeared from my consciousness. My 14-year-old gut told me, listen to Seabrook. I managed to transport my suitcase and myself to my room on the fourth floor by taking an elevator that the janitor unlocked for me. I unpacked and mingled with the other new students. Most of us were preps. There were a few 10th graders, known as lowers, and a few 11th grade uppers and 12th grade seniors. As we introduced ourselves to each other, the first question after, "Where are you from?" was, "You scholarship boy?" The dorm reverberated with conversation all morning, right up to lunchtime. What sport are you going to play? Who do you have for math? Who's your advisor? We were doing more than making conversation. We were sizing up each other's verbal skills in anticipation of our future competitions in the classroom. The verbal jousting continued as I sat down with six other preps for my first meal. I had already met three of them while reconnoitering the dorm. John, like me, was a scholarship boy from Salem, Massachusetts. Jeff, four. Joseph E. Fellows III, whose father had gone to Exeter, was also from Salem. His roommate, Brink, four. Van Wyck Brinkerhoff IV, whose father had also gone to Exeter, was from San Antonio, Texas. Brink, Jeff and I were the smallest of our group. We must have looked like little boys playing dress-up in our jackets and ties. John, with his strawberry blonde crew cut, was the tallest and, from afar, no doubt looked like a senior eating with the preps. Dick, Bill, and Ben, other preps at the table, all introduced themselves and volunteered where they were from. Suddenly, in the midst of all the animated conversations around the table, Brink said to someone in his right, "You nigger." Just as suddenly, a deep New England silence absorbed every decibel of prep chatter. All eyes focused on me, the only Negro in the dining room. I looked past Brink's brown crew cut and noticed Seabrook smiling at his two teenage daughters at the faculty table in the corner before centering my gaze on Brinks. Speaking without thinking, I said, "Don't use that word." Then continued in an even softer voice, saying, "It hurts my feelings." Brink mumbled a fumbling apology, and the preps' chatter resumed within minutes, albeit at a more subdued level. Brink's response, the fact that he expressed genuine embarrassment and vulnerability rather than attempting some elegant verbal twist to remove the social sting of what had just occurred, actually drew me to him. At that moment, responding to Brink, I had to bury my father's fears about this world I had chosen to inhabit. I made an unspoken vow never to tell anyone in my family about this incident. I also vowed never to tell Seabrook or anyone else at Exeter about Brinks' use of the word nigger to denigrate a white boy in my presence, hoping to preserve the possibilities of a future friendship uncomplicated by racial suspicion. Exeter seemed a world away from the rest of the country's racial tensions and conflicts. Emmett Till's murder in 1955, armed troops escorting nine Negro teenagers into Central High School in Little Rock in 1957. The bill enacted by the Arkansas legislature in 1958, opposing desegregation of Little Rock schools. The fact that my parents and all of my older siblings had been born in Arkansas made such events regular topics of Palmer family conversations. Towards the end of these discussions, a parent or older sibling would inevitably extract some moral from a particular news story that young Barry and I should take to heart, lapsing into a sing-song Central Arkansas drawl to explain how to deal with whites in general, or how to distinguish okay white people from those who might try to harm. or insult us. When I got up my nerve the next day to go to the barbershop in the basement of one of the main academic buildings, my confidence was briefly shaken by the age of the barber. The white-haired, respectable man looked like a retired barber at best. Maybe I should have gone downtown to find a younger man with steadier hands. I pondered this as he smiled kindly, and then he startled me with a question. How do you want your hair cut? Well, my dad had never asked me what I wanted my hair to look like. Staring into this barber's mirror, I imagined myself transformed into a movie star like a Harry Belafonte. But my immediate problem brought me back to earth in a hurry. Have you ever cut a Negro's hair? I asked the old man tentatively. No, he replied gently, focusing his pale eyes on my reflection in the mirror. What do you think would be the best way for me to begin? Clippers or comb and scissors? Clippers, I've replied a bit more confident. But let me comb it out first. I took out the sturdy Hercules comb I had brought with me, worked out all the kinks I could, and told the barber to leave about 3 inches on the top and make the sides a bit shorter. I could see his reflection as he examined various comb-like attachments on the shelf behind him, and when he picked up one of them and attached it to his electric clippers. Dad did not have any attachment for his handhelds. In a moment of truth, the barber flipped them on. I could barely see the teeth of the rapidly moving blades or how they worked, but I imagined the motor replacing Dad's heavy hands. Its noise and the singing of those fast-moving blades reminded me of June bugs, the flying beetles Barry and I used to catch and put into jars back in St. Luke. The buzz of these electric blades was nothing like the slow clip-clop of Dad's clippers. I scrutinized the barber's every move in his large mirror, more astonished than frightened. He used various plastic attachments to cut my side, stopping occasionally to ask if he had taken off enough. I could never actually see what Dad was doing when sitting bibbed for a trim back home. I noticed my neck was relaxed because somehow I knew there was little chance these electric shears would clog in my hair. The barber found the top more of a challenge. Even though he used several different guards, he had some trouble cutting the hair even. There were no gaping holes, only little valleys dipping here and there that I could probably obscure through rigorous combing, brushing, and hefty amounts of Vitalis. Later that night, after dinner, I knocked on Bedford's office door, trying to anticipate what he would say about my haircut. Come in! He shouted through the closed but unlocked door. Palmer! He began in his usual impassioned manner as I walked towards his desk. Did you see this morning's Boston Globe? Bedford was a walking and talking encyclopedia on what was changing in the world, gleaned from his absorption of both the Boston Globe and the New York Times every day. Before I could answer, he went on to tell me about another French colony gaining its independence from France. I assured him I would read the Globe, but began to wonder if he understood why I was there. He pushed his chair back from his desk, extracted my permission slip, and without so much as a word about my hair, signed it and laid it in my upturned palm.